so welcome everybody to the podcast, and I'm delighted to be rejoined by the wonderful Mr. Simon Clark. I can't even say it. I'll start again. Oh, I'm nervous now. I can see you.
Don't you say that? I'll turn the camera off.
No, well, if it's up to you. Yeah, you can do. Let's turn the cameras off.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this week's Nail as Natter. I am joined by Mr. Simon Cox, my former colleague and Blackpool Research School Director, and we'll be delving deep into the evidence base around remote and blended learning. In this episode, I'll be asking Simon about what the evidence shows and how you can apply that in your own virtual classroom, and we'll also be looking into Simon's impeccable music taste when he selects three tracks that have influenced him in his life and in his career. Stay tuned.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Welcome everybody to the podcast, and welcome to our returning guest. It's the marvellous Mr. Simon Cox. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
And of course, listeners who have been listening to me rabbiting on other people's podcasts will know Simon's part in the origin of the podcast originally. So, you know, when it's successful, he can be the co-founder, and when it's hopeless, he can have nothing to do with it. So that's absolutely brilliant. Okay, let's get into the podcast. So the reason that Simon's joining us this evening is we're going to be talking through the EEF's Guide to Remote Learning. So what we're going to be talking about is all of the different points there. And I know it's very much of the moment and people are really interested in that. So we're going to get straight into it because we don't need the gentle introductory questions, you'll be pleased to know. So, Simon, let's start off with, could you start by telling us why teaching quality is more important than how lessons are delivered?
Yeah, absolutely. So just before I do that, I think just a little bit of a red flag about the sort of the evidence that went into this review. So clearly there's a bit of an issue because we don't necessarily have evidence to draw upon where school age children have been working at home for any long periods of time. It hasn't really happened before, thankfully. So a lot of the evidence that went into the evidence review is actually based upon university age students, some younger, some a little bit older. So that's just something to bear in mind when we're talking about this. So we're pretty confident that the evidence is strong enough to sort of extrapolate, but there is always that out there that it actually wasn't based upon necessarily school age children. So yeah, the first thing we found actually was quite reassuring in that pupils can actually learn remotely. You know, we aren't wasting our time here. So we could have been, you know, we could have found actually, do you know what, there's no point actually in trying to deliver any kind of remote learning, let's just wait until they're back in school. We didn't find that. We found that there is actually some benefit in teaching remotely. But the main thing, and as you just mentioned, was this idea that it doesn't seem to matter how the lessons are delivered. So I know there's a big debate going on at the moment about live lessons and pre-recorded lessons and synchronous and asynchronous, that they're called in the report. Actually, we didn't find any particular difference between that. What we did find that really mattered was the teaching quality, as you'd expect. I mean, that's good to hear as a teacher, isn't it? That the quality of the teaching is the thing that mattered rather than the platform on which it was being delivered. So we're not saying that live or recorded are any better or worse than each other. We're not saying that schools should do one over the other. I think we're just saying here that actually it doesn't seem to matter. So do what's best for you and for your students. You know, schools know their staff, they know their communities, they know their context. And they're best placed to make those decisions rather than saying, well, live is always best. I think there's this temptation, isn't there, to try and replicate what we do in the classroom. It seems like, you know, because that's what happened in the classroom, that should be what happens when they're learning remotely. We didn't necessarily find that. So recorded or live is both fine. So things like the explanations that you're doing. So if you are using pre-recorded videos, and I know I'm a maths teacher and there's loads of sites out there which offer pre-recorded explanations of maths topics, and they're fine, but they're only okay if the teachers are actually happy with the quality of the explanations that's in those videos. And if you're not, you should probably record your own or do a live version. So it's about getting the quality of explanation right. Things like scaffolding, I think, are probably more important than ever when children are learning remotely. You know, you get that feel in the classroom, don't you? If something's not going quite right, you think, right, I'm going to stop this. I'm going to explain it in a different way. I'm going to go back a few steps or whatever. And that can be really difficult when pupils are learning at home. So really making sure that scaffolding is built into everything that we do, and that we try and make sure that we're not leaving anyone behind. And I think one real positive, I think, of this finding about the, you know, live versus sort of pre-recorded debate is around the digital divide. I mean, there are lots of reasons why we might choose not to go live. But there's all sorts of, you know, scenarios up and down the country that parents are having to contend with. Some parents just don't have the devices that they need. They might have the devices, but actually they've got internet that can't really cope with streaming 3 or 4 lessons simultaneously for all their different children. They might have devices, but not enough to go around. So there's a sharing aspect going on there. And again, if they all have to log on at the same time, that can be a problem. But even if everything is in place and they've got all the devices that they need and so on, you know, a lot of parents are trying to work from home. I know this because I've been working from home a bit, and I've got 2 very young children, and it's really challenging. So again, there might be some challenges there. So I think because of that, I think yeah, there is this tendency for us to think that live is going to be best every time, and we're not saying it's not good or it can't be good. It absolutely can be. I think we're just saying to schools, you know, just do what you think is best for your kids. Don't think that because, you know, politicians or, you know, breakfast TV presenters or whoever are clamouring for live lessons, don't necessarily think that they're going to be any better.
No, definitely not. And it's quite interesting. There's a lot of points within that. So just to go into the live lessons debate, and as we record this, and also as we put this out, it'll probably be a week since we've recorded it, so things may have moved on because they tend to do that pretty quickly. But there's a lot of debate around live versus recorded, as you say. But even the pedagogy, Simon, that goes within those lessons. So, you know, some people are taking it literally. So I'm doing a live lesson, which means that I have to be, and I don't quite know why, because you wouldn't necessarily do this in your own lesson normally in front of the students, but they feel as if it's got to be 100 minutes of teacher input, of them talking, imparting information all the way through. And, you know, is there any, I know it's difficult at this stage to say, but is there any evidence around sort of pedagogies within the lesson and whether you should try to replicate similar to what you're doing in lessons, or like you said, is that all contextual as well?
Yeah, I mean, that didn't really come out in the EEF review, so I'm not really looking at that here. But like you say, that there is, I think that from what I'm seeing sort of anecdotally on Twitter and talking to people and things, teachers that are expected to literally be, you know, putting on a show for an hour or an hour and a half or however long it happens to be, and really making sure that they're fully engaging. I think there's a halfway ground here, isn't there? You know, maybe sort of 10-15 minutes of live input at the start, and then over to the kids, and they start doing, you know, the activity as they would in the lesson. You know, as you rightly said, you wouldn't stand there as a teacher, well, you might occasionally, but you wouldn't normally sort of deliver for an hour and a half, 100 minutes, whatever it happens to be. So for me, it's about getting that balance right. It's about making sure that you're thinking about what's right for your teacher. I mean, I know how exhausting it is on Teams and on Zoom and on things like that. You know, there's been days when I've spent 5-6 hours on Zoom calls, and at the end of it, you are absolutely shattered. I think that it seems to be more tiring than actually being in the meetings live. I think it's because you're on camera and you're constantly thinking you have to be looking at the camera and things like that. So, no, I think, you know, we have to be wary of our sort of staff workload. I think some people have set off all guns blazing, and that's great. We don't know how long this is going to go on for. It could be 6 weeks. It could be 2 months. It could even be longer. Are we going to be able to sustain that level of engagement that far down the line? I'd be surprised if some people are, to be honest. So I think there's a happy medium here. And I think that, you know, providing some pre-recorded, providing some, you know, annotated works examples, providing some live content so they can see your face and hear your voice, because that's important. I think there's a happy medium, and I'd be reluctant to go, you know, too far one way or the other, to be honest.
No, and it's really interesting to hear your kind of take on this. And I was only talking about you today because I was saying to some of our staff at school that I've become the kind of person that I used to talk about and say, you know, oh, how can they possibly know what it's like in the classroom, as they're never in the classroom, yet they're leading CPD, telling us all how to do it. Now, you know, full disclosure, listeners, apologies for the fact that I'm out of the classroom at the moment. I'm hoping it's temporary. But, you know, as senior leaders listening to this up and down the country will know, we seem to have become specialists in all sorts of areas that we never thought we would, whether that's, you know, lateral flow experts or, you know, risk assessment kings or queens or whatever it'll be. So we're doing everything but the teacher. So it's good to hear your kind of reflections on what that looks like. And like you said, particularly, you know, when you're at home trying to juggle, you know, young children in the house as well, it is quite a challenge.
Yeah, yeah, it absolutely is. And you know, I'm in a similar position to you, Phil. I you know, by no means teach anything like as much as I used to. And it is really tough. And I think that's a really important thing for senior leaders to bear in mind is, you know, we might think it's best to go all out and replicate the full timetable and make sure kids are sort of sat in front of the computer from 9 till 3:30 or whatever, doing their full lessons, all live, all singing, all dancing. I just don't think that's sustainable in the longer term. And I think we've got to be thinking about what we can do to try to make this sustainable if, you know, God forbid it does go on for longer than we might think it does.
No, definitely. So in terms of the next question, you touched on it in your previous answer, but we started talking about having access to technology. Now, again, you know, we're talking to everybody across the country, but we work in areas of, you know, exceptionally high disadvantage. So in the report, it talks about ensuring access to technology is key, particularly for those disadvantaged pupils. Now, I know this is not an easy question to say, but what kind of things can we do to kind of mitigate or overcome some of those challenges?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough one, depending on who you are and what your role in school is. And I don't think there's any suggestion here that classroom teachers should be sort of going out of their way to try and ensure that all their kids have got access to technology. That's not within our gift usually as a classroom teacher. I think it's an important finding because a lot of remote learning is by definition digital, although interesting that they are not always one and the same. And I think sometimes we think too much about the digital when we're thinking about remote learning. I was interested to read in the Ofsted materials that came out recently that they made that distinction and actually said, look, remote learning doesn't have to be digital all the time. And I think that's important, particularly for families who, you know, might struggle with that and internet connection. Again, I think we talk too much about devices sometimes, and we talk about laptops. You're constantly hearing laptops from the DfE, but actually you can have all the laptops you want, but try and stream 10 different Teams lessons at the same time and your internet connection will very soon fall over. So that's important as well. So I don't think there's an awful lot as classroom teachers we can do about it, but certainly at a government level, and I know, you know, to be positive about the DfE, you know, that the laptops are rolling out now and there are certainly a lot more out there than there were. But also I think senior leadership teams can possibly sort of try to redeploy some of the resources they've got in school. I know schools have access to laptops a lot of the time, trolleys full of laptops, sometimes trolleys full of iPads and so on. So some kind of audit of family need and then sort of redeploying some of those resources, because even though we have got kids in school, we've certainly not got the numbers we'd normally have, and so we might be able to use those to lend out to families or you know, whatever it happens to be. So I certainly think there's things we can do at a school level once we identify those families, but it's knowing, isn't it? And if we don't know, we can't always support. So that kind of an audit process I think is really important. Really pleasing actually to see that some education sites are going over to zero data now, and I think that's important. I know, you know, Phil, we both work in Blackpool and have done for quite some time now, and Blackpool is a particularly deprived region of the country, and a lot of families a lot of the time only have access to internet via a mobile phone, and it eats data. You know, if you try and watch a video on a mobile phone, you're going to use up your data allowance in no time. So actually the fact that some of those have now gone to zero rating in terms of data, I think is a real positive, and will certainly help with this recommendation about ensuring access to technology.
Great. And I mean, moving forward, I mean, I spoke to Janice Allen last week about this idea that, you know, once we ever do kind of transition back into school being, you know, either slightly more open or fully open, that we'll probably have to be retaining some form of remote teaching or that sort of approach to it, sort of a blended approach. And I think your point there is a really good one about repurposing devices that are within school in some sort of library system in a similar way to you would do with books, to be able to lend those laptops out, bring them back in, you know, as and when year groups are on site. I think they're really practical and really good points.
I think it's going to be really interesting actually to see where all this goes once we eventually get back to normal. I think, you know, we're in a position, I was just thinking the other day about, you know, rewind a year, and I'd never been on Teams. I'd never used Zoom. And now we do it all day. We're familiar with it. Every teacher in our school is familiar with it. I mean, when has that ever happened before, when every single teacher has been familiar with the technology needed for things like this? People are using things like Google Classroom, and it's I can't imagine we're going to go back to a point where we just don't use any of that. Now, I don't know what it'll look like. You know, probably won't be kids working at home, but certainly this idea of using tools like Google Classroom and things like that to create. We tried it years ago, didn't we? I mean, you've been teaching the same amount of time as I have, and you'll remember VLEs, and you know, every school had someone in charge of the VLE and spent ages uploading things and nobody ever looked at it. And I don't think the time was right for that kind of thing then, but I think actually now it'll be just interesting to see what happens.
No, it certainly will. And I mean, if only we'd known about this technology at the kind of outset of the podcast. And I mean, you know, I might have to cut this section, but I can distinctly remember in the Blackpool Research School cupboard/office and, you know, me and you on one phone trying to record into an iPad with Daniel Merz from Ofsted. You know, at the level of it. Now, if we had this technology, it was all on every single one of our computers already. You know, yeah. We had the ability to be able to do this, but we didn't have a clue. And you're right, we've shifted to this pretty, pretty quickly. And it's something for another podcast at some point where we can talk about, as in, what is the future of CPD and what kind of role does this format play in that? But we'll leave that one for the discussion, because we'll, you know, I'll try and keep on topic for once. So the next bit we're looking at is about peer interactions. Now, obviously, that's much more challenging when people are in their own homes. So peer interaction can provide motivation and improve learning outcomes, the report says. So how can teachers manage this for remote learning? And this isn't really mentioned in the report, but obviously there are some students that are within school, working within bubbles in, you know, key worker and vulnerable classrooms. So is there anything that they can do in terms of peer interaction, be it online or actually, you know, in the classroom from a safe distance, all, you know, safety procedures being adhered to, of course?
Of course, yeah. It's an interesting one, this, isn't it? Because when kids are working at home, teachers often working at home, there's a nervousness around peer interactions that I can completely understand. You know, the safeguarding issues, we don't want necessarily to set up a situation where students can chat with each other and that kind of thing. You know, there's goodness knows there's enough of that going on already. We don't need to set up any more of it. So I think there is a nervousness there in terms of how can we actually get kids to interact at a work kind of level, because the evidence does suggest it is important. It can motivate, it can improve learning, as it does in the classroom, you know, and we all use some form of peer interaction in the classroom, don't we? Whatever it happens to be in terms of our lessons. So it's thinking of ways in which we can try and replicate that for students who are working remotely. There's a really good blog by Sandringham Research School on this. They were particularly, they're an EdTech demonstrator school as well as a research school. They did a lot of work way back in lockdown one, if you remember that far back, on peer interactions and ways that they could get kids looking at each other's work. So a really simple idea that they share is using something like Google Docs or one of the other equivalents from a different provider. It's really easy to share pieces of work. So, you know, good examples of pieces of work that kids have done, you can click a button, you can share it with the whole class. They can have a look at it, but you can even sort of pair students up. So they don't actually talk to each other as in you know, live, but they can comment on each other's work. So they can look through each other's work, they can make notes on it, they can comment, and you always have to do a bit of training with them as to how to do that and the kinds of things that are positive to say and helpful to say. But something like that is a nice easy way of doing that kind of thing. This is one benefit of live lessons, is that actually, you know, you have got all the kids there, they have all got access to microphones and cameras. So finding some way of having some kind of interaction within that kind of environment. So I think here you have to have really clear protocols in place and be really, you know, clear about what you expect and you know, when cameras should be off and on and microphones and that kind of thing. But again, it is possible. But I think that the main thing here is this idea that collaboration is important. And if it was just a week or so that they were going to be out of the classroom, I don't think it made that much of a difference. But when we're talking about, you know, a half term or even longer, providing those opportunities for that kind of feedback can be really beneficial. Now, those kids working in school is a different thing altogether, isn't it? Because, you know, what we'd normally do there is sit them next to each other and have a look at each other's work. Not always possible at the moment. I saw, and I've got no idea who this was, so I apologise if this was somebody that's listening, but it was on Twitter a while ago, where a teacher had set up a visualizer, a safe 2 meter distance from their desk, and so the kids could go up and put their work under the visualizer, then go back to their place, and then the class could look at that piece of work, and the teacher could comment on it, and then the student would come and take that book back. So, you know, it's the kind of thing which would normally be dead easy. You'd just walk around the room and look over the shoulder, but it's a way of having that kind of interaction in a safe environment, but still given the opportunity for that kind of peer feedback and also teacher feedback on a piece of work. I'm sure there's loads of other examples out there, but that's just a couple that I've come across.
Yeah, and they're really good examples, and I think that's what teachers are looking for, aren't they, really, is like practical examples of how you can go about doing this. And something that leads on from that is around engagement. Now, you know, I'm sure that people have been in a lot of discussions, whether it be departmental level, phase level, whatever it is, about students that are online but are kind of sitting there and not necessarily engaging. Now, there can be a lot of different reasons for that. So you're going to be joining me next week to interview Daniel Mears. We've mentioned him twice now in the same interview, so, you know, we might mention him in the playlist later on with his death metal choices, but probably not. So maybe we could ask him about this, but lots of people will be wrestling with the idea of engagement, and their blog about, and they had some common myths about remote education in there that said that it isn't the most important thing in terms of pupils' engagement. So, you know, what would you say? And again, you know, I'll edit this bit later on if you want, and put you on the spot, Coxie, so don't worry, I can always seamlessly edit this bit out. But, you know, we've had discussions around it now. So people are sat in the lesson, but not necessarily participating in it. So one, how does that really matter too much? And two, what do you do if that's the case?
It's really hard, isn't it? Because I think I've been in meetings where I've been doing that, to be honest. You know, so sometimes it's
I know really, I have.
It's really easy to switch off, and especially when your camera's off and your microphone's off, and you know, your mind starts to drift. And in terms of what to do about battles, don't we? I think as long as we are making sure that we are delivering in the best way that we can, and making sure that our lessons have got all the things we normally would expect them to, I don't think there's an awful lot really that we necessarily can do. I think getting parents on board here is a good one. Obviously, not always helping with the work itself, and it, certainly in maths there's evidence that suggests that actually encouraging parents to help with the work might do more harm than good, especially at secondary level, where a lot of people just don't have that access to the subject knowledge necessarily. But certainly having parents aware of, you know, the kind of setup we'd expect as a school when engaging with a live lesson or a recorded lesson. So maybe having, you know, a computer in an area of the house that the parents could see and could access, and to sort of make sure that engagement is as high as it can be. I just don't think it's ever something that you're ever going to completely get rid of, unfortunately, because I don't think it's something you get rid of in adults, never mind young people. And I just think we have to make the best of what we can with that, really.
Yeah, and I think your point about, you know, involving parents in that is really, really important. And, you know, I mean, if I'm allowed to give out good shout outs to my son's school, I won't necessarily name them, but they might know who they are. You know, they are doing so much in terms of whole school assemblies. They're doing so much in terms of going online, and the number of newsletters that I get pretty much daily telling me what's going on is giving me really good information as a parent to, like you said, I couldn't even entertain the possibility of getting involved in year seven maths, or whatever it might be. I mean, year seven biology and hopefully chemistry as well, maybe, but some of the other stuff. But they're telling me exactly what kind of things to be doing. And, you know, they're even setting, you know, assignments to do later on, or longer term assignments. So like your point there is really good about getting engagement through involvement and getting everybody around the child, if you like, involved in that.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a level of this, isn't it? And it's, you know, we're all learning, none of us. And it's quite interesting that you've got for the first time I can remember, you've literally got every single person, no matter rank, what rank they are in a school, all as clueless as each other, you know, because none of us really know how remote learning works and all that. And we're all learning as we go along. And I think that this is one area where we're not going to crack it. We just have to try and make the best of it. And, you know, you're always going to have exceptions, as you do in the classroom, let's be honest. But I think getting the parents on board is a useful strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is something that we touched on a little bit earlier in terms of different subjects. So you're teaching maths, for example, and it says the next recommendation is that different approaches to remote learning suit different types of content and pupils and schools. Sorry, I'll start that again. Different approaches to remote learning suit different types of content and pupils and schools best to avoid prescriptive approaches to this idea. So, you know, should we be saying, right, every lesson should involve this, every lesson should involve that, or should we be leaving it more to the subject teachers, you know, the particular phase teachers or particular year group teachers or, you know, heads of department, whatever it might be? Is there different pedagogies for different subjects, as there would be at different times when you're in school?
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. For me, this recommendation really is no different to your everyday classroom teaching back in school. I don't think we should be saying every lesson should contain this, whether it's a PE lesson or a history lesson or a maths lesson or a Key Stage 1 lesson or a Key Stage 3 lesson or whatever it happens to be. I think, you know, different subjects are necessarily different, and when we start to actually mandate exactly what everybody's lesson should look like, we're going to lose something in terms of the subject's expertise and the different things that work for different subjects. So one of the things that we found in the evidence review was playing games for learning vocabulary was really effective in modern foreign languages, but less effective for some other subjects. So if we started saying, you know, everybody must play games in their lessons, the languages teachers would be quids in, the rest of us might not be. And so we probably shouldn't say that. We probably should just say, actually, you know, find out what works best for your subject. It might be that there's some evidence out there, it might be that there isn't, but follow what would normally happen in the classroom rather than going sort of too deep into the, you know, remote learning rabbit hole in terms of trying to find things that might not be there. But no, I think, you know, my wife's an art teacher, I'm a maths teacher. Our lessons are going to look really, really different. They should look really, really different. And I don't think remote learning is any different to that in terms of the expectations. Now, there might also be an argument here about things like live and pre-recorded. So it could be that we find that live lessons work really well in a particular subject for our kids, and pre-recorded ones work particularly well in a different subject, you know, where they can rewind and play things back and watch it again. And again, I don't think we should necessarily be saying that everyone has to stick to the same thing there. So, I think, having said that, I do think there is a place for some kind of consistency of platforms. So what I wouldn't say is that we should have one department using Zoom and one department using Google Meet and one department using Teams, because that's just really confusing as a parent, as a young person. I don't think that's helpful. So I think consistency of platform is useful, certainly for setting work and parents knowing where to find it. But after that, I think we should really, you know, let subject leaders know their subjects as they do.
Completely. Just to finish off this little section of the podcast. So obviously, this guidance report is available. So if you just tell us a little bit more about where we can find it and maybe a little bit more about what you as a Blackpool Research School are kind of doing with this report and maybe anything that you're doing. I know it's challenging circumstances and difficult times, but anything that you're doing in terms of CPD, because I know you're doing lots of great work with newsletters, etc., and getting the message out. So just tell us listeners a little bit more about where they can find out more about Blackpool Research School.
Yeah, absolutely. So the report, first of all, if you just Google EEF remote learning, you'll find the report. That there's, as is often with the EEF, there's two versions. There's a very quick, easy to read version that's one side of A4, and then there's a much more in-depth report that sits behind that, which you can have a read through, but I find the A4 sheet to be the one that I keep going back to. That's where you'll find that. You'll also find lots of other resources linked to sort of COVID-19 on the EEF website, so things for parents, things around reading, particularly for younger children, and various other things there as well. It's actually a year old now, it was sort of April last year this report came out, and it's quite disappointing that we're still talking about it, because I think it would have been nice to sort of find out initially what it was all about and then be in a position to leave it behind. But you know, unfortunately it has come around again. So that's all there. In terms of Blackpool Research School, yeah, we have a newsletter. If you go on our website, the website for the Research Schools Network is researchschool.org.uk, and then you can find us on there in Blackpool, sign up for our newsletter. That comes out about every month or so, and we'll just put in there, you know, links to anything that's come out recently in terms of evidence. We'll have blogs on there from the Research School Network, you know, sort of tips and things about how they're putting evidence into action. And there's also things in there about anything we've got coming up. And we do a lot of sort of free Twilight sessions, as well as some longer training courses, which are all now delivered remotely for obvious reasons. But yeah, that's all on the website as well.
You've reached the midpoint of the interview with Simon Cox on remote and blended learning. An exciting development for Naylor's Natter. Simon will be choosing the tracks of his years, three tracks that have influenced Simon in his teaching career and in his life in general. So stay tuned for the discussion on Simon Cox and his tracks of his years.
Great stuff. So for the more experienced listener, you will notice that although we didn't do an introduction for the reason that we said at the beginning that obviously Simon has been on before, this is going to be the first of a new venture for Naylor's Natter, something a little bit different. So I've been fortunate enough to acquire myself, sounds like I've done it dodgily, I've bought a music license. So we're able to start playing some music on here. And I thought there's no better person, having shared an office and a few road trips with Mr. Cox over the years. He's a man of impeccable taste, you know, in clothing, music, film and fragrance, listeners, let me tell you. So I thought he could be the first person to kind of pioneer this, find out a little bit more about the guests through their musical choices. So we're going to give this a try. And what Simon's going to do is he's going to talk to us about three songs that have kind of influenced him or had an effect on him growing up or maybe even through his teaching career. So if you've got yourself a pen and paper now and you want to start making notes of these collections to make yourself look even cooler than maybe you are already, this is the point to start being interested. So, Simon, what is your first choice of track? And of course, it'll be vinyl, won't it? Because there's no other medium for you, is there? It'll be vinyl.
Always vinyl. I'm just thinking the way you've picked me up there, wouldn't it be awful if I'd chosen Take That or something?
no offence to any Take That fans.
Nothing wrong with Take That, obviously. This has been playing on my mind all day, Phil, since you asked me about this morning, because trying to choose three things for me is really, really difficult. And I know I'll regret some of these choices tomorrow and think, oh, I should have chosen that one instead. But the first one on my list is the first track off the Kid A album by Radiohead, and the track's called Everything in Its Right Place. And the only reason I picked the first track is because it's the first track and it was the first thing I'd heard off the album, because the whole album's absolutely fantastic. The reason for picking this is this came out, it was a bit revolutionary when it came out. Radiohead were quite a big band at the time, quite guitar based, and they did this album on the quiet and they released it with no singles and no promotion, which was unheard of at the time, and just put it out there, and it was completely different to anything they'd done before, and it was quite electronic, although still the guitars were there, and really sort of set their sort of career in a completely different path over the subsequent 20 years. So yeah, Everything in Its Right Place is named the first track. Great track, but from an even better album. Everything comes in this world. Sorry, when did you first come across this track then? When was this first kind of on your horizon? What year would this have been? Gosh, it was, you're asking a question there, I'm not sure. I reckon it was probably around about 2000-ish. So I was probably in my early 20s at the time when that's it. So I've been a Radiohead fan for years. It wasn't their first album. I think it was actually the third album that released. But yeah, it was around about then. So it was before I came into teaching, but sort of around about sort of just after university. So I was probably I did a civil service job for 2 years for a couple of years after I left uni before I came into teaching. So it was around about that time. And yeah, it's kind of changed the way I thought about music at the time, because I was very much into sort of guitar based stuff at that time, and it sort of set me off on a different track altogether.
Okay, so yes, on to track two then. So tell us a little bit about track two, where you came across this, how this has influenced you, why perhaps listeners should go and have a look at this track.
Yeah, so this one this one is pretty obscure, I'll be honest, Phil. This is by a guy called William Basinski, and he is a composer. He's still active now. He's in his 60s now, but this track is called Disintegration Loops, and it's actually the first of quite a number of tracks in the series. It's quite long, you know, it's about half an hour, 40 minutes long, but it is just a single track. And this is a fascinating story that came sort of behind this. So back in the 80s, when he was first starting out, he was really inspired by a lot of people who were using tape loops, who were finding sounds, whether it was sort of occurring naturally or taken from old records and things like that. And he made all of these loops. And he had them on an old style sort of cassette, not a cassette tape, but the kind of tape that you use in the studio. And years down the line, so we're talking about early 2000s here, he decided that he needed to get these tapes out of the attic and transfer them on something digital that was going to last a bit longer. So he started doing that, and he left these tapes playing. And what he noticed was that as they were playing, because they were so old and they hadn't been kept in particularly good condition, they were actually disintegrating before his eyes. And every time this tape looped round, it sounded slightly different, because bits of the tape were falling off. And over time and across the course of the piece of music, it actually sort of ends up as nothing, because it has completely disintegrated, hence the name. And that on its own, I think, is an interesting story. But then coincidentally, he lived in New York at the time, and on the day he finished this project of transferring these tapes onto digital, it was September the 11th, 2001, and he went up to his rooftop to listen to the digitized versions of these disintegrating tapes as the planes hit the Twin Tower. And so clearly, you know, there was this. He just sat there sort of all day with it. He had a little camcorder going as well, listening to these loops and sort of watching the world disintegrate around him. So it's a fascinating story. It's not an easy listen. I'm not going to pretend it is, and it's a bit out there, but well worth exploring if you haven't done already. That's Disintegration Loops by William Basinski.
Wow, and this is exactly why we invited you on. So already I can feel that my horizons have been expanded considerably by this. I had no idea. So I'm just sitting here at the moment just trying to find that track on Apple Music, and it's just, yeah, I've found it now. So Disintegration Loops. Wow, what a story. So there you go, you see. That's why Mr. Cox is first on the music recommendations. There is something outside of, I would hazard a guess, at most people's normal playlist. And certainly, I don't think it was on the B-side of Take That's Prey, as I remember. So there we go. Brilliant. Right, well, you've set us up with two crackers here. So the third and final choice in your, which I don't know what we're going to call this section. You know, I can't call it Desert Island Discs. I believe someone's taken that. But the third track on this section of finding out a little bit more about you through music. So what is the track and why did you choose it?
Okay, last one. I'm going to cheat a little bit here, because it isn't really a track, because it's an album made up of tracks, none of which have a title. It's by Aphex Twin. And Aphex Twin is one of my all-time favourite artists. So I first discovered his music. I was really quite young, actually, probably about 13, 14 when he first came out onto the scene. Really mysterious character. He told a lot of tall stories to the press, most of which probably weren't true about who he was and his background and so on. And he was into some quite sort of dance type music at the time, but then sort of toned it down quite a lot and came out with an album which came out when I was, I'm pretty sure I was about 17, so probably about 1994, and it's called Selected Ambient Works Volume 2. So we'd already had one volume which was a bit more upbeat, and this one it kind of stripped all the beats away, and it's a long album. It's double vinyl. In fact, it might even be triple vinyl, actually. It goes on for a good sort of hour and a half. But he gets so much out of so little. You know, there's a lot of space in this album, and a lot of not many beats. And I say none of the tracks have got titles, so it's really difficult to identify them. But really, really great piece of music. I find it great at the moment for working from home. So whenever I'm working, that's one of the things that I often have on in the background. It's one of those albums where you, the more you listen to it, the more you get from it. So it's you know, really recommended. So yeah, a bit of a cheat there. It's not a track because they don't actually have titles, but Selected Ambient Works Volume 2 by Aphex Twin.
I don't even need to introduce the tracks now. You're already doing it for me. This is superb. Superb. We're straight in. So there we go. Yeah, and again, for the working from home, that's a whole new angle we can look at. So thanks to one of your recommendations, you know, on the rare occasions that at the moment, and this is not because I'm some kind of martyr, I just happen to be the DSL, as listeners will know, so I do tend to be on site, but when I am working from home, you know, I often listen to Brian Eno, which was one of your recommendations there. So I often have the sounds of Eno, you know, whether it's film music, which is always a favourite. And I quite like, you know, ambient music one, Music for Airports, which I know is one of your favourites as well.
So yeah, have that absolutely. One on. Do you know what? That was the music that we had playing in the background when people came into our wedding. So there you go. Ambient through and through.
That is superb. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I don't even want to tell people what I had. Well, I might as well now, hadn't I? So, Simon, this is the difference between when we were the research school team. You know, you've got one of us who's extremely cool and everyone was looking to for influence. And then there's me who, for the song, everyone normally has a sort of smoochy wedding dance. And when I got married, I had Boom Shake the Room by DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. So there you go, listeners, in a nutshell. Is what's wrong with me in terms of musical taste. And also I did the rap as well, which is just really quite embarrassing, and I don't know why I'm admitting it. So if you've enjoyed finding out a little bit more about that, then obviously you can find those tracks. They'll be linked in on the episode to Spotify or Apple Music, so you can pick those up. Right, Mr. Cox, just to say, what a pleasure to speak to you again this evening. Really, really enjoyed it. And looking forward to you joining me next week when we will be speaking to Daniel Mers from Ofsted around, you know, the commonalities between the EEF guidance and what Ofsted are talking about now. And hopefully, you know, as you do best, translating the evidence into practice and hopefully giving the listeners a few more tips around what sort of things they can do remote learning wise. So thank you for tonight. Much appreciated.
No, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.